I'm Jane Stroll. I know some of you were here yesterday, so pardon the repetition of introductions, but for people who get the tapes, they need to know who I am and what I'm doing. I teach at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary in Berkeley, California, which is also part of the Graduate Theological Union. It's the one of our ELCA seminaries that is formally committed in a project of both first seminary degree and postgraduate degrees in theology, and everything we do ecumenically. So it's a very interesting place to be indeed. My field is Reformation history and theology, and that is the position I hold at PLTS, and taught similar things for 11 years previous to that at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. So, yesterday we talked some about Luther, his own background, and the topic I'd like to take up today is our teaching about sin. I've entitled it The Sickness Unto Death, which is a way that Luther himself referred to it. But I think that it is, as one of the class participants yesterday pointed out, our general feeling is if you don't have a good, healthy sense of what sin is about, you can't really appreciate grace. As one of my friends said, I don't know, that's a little akin to saying you won't know a good relationship until you've kissed a lot of frogs, and I'm not sure I go with that. And I think this is often a problem for people, is that this doctrine of sin is seen as actually harmful to human thriving rather than helpful. I'd like to talk to you a bit today, both first starting with some of the reactions to it, then looking again at what our confessional understanding says about sin, and what I think are helpful ways to appropriate it and interpret it in a contemporary setting. I mentioned yesterday that in a more mellow time of my life, I used to do yoga. Now I'm lucky if I can scramble things enough to get to an aerobics class, and I think, why are you coming here to make noise and jump up and down? That's generally what your life looks like the rest of the time. But in the days when I could do yoga, I remember I would read this journal. It's called the Yoga Journal, and primarily for some indications, but good instructions about postures and different approaches. But it was also, as a teacher of theology, fascinating for me to read a publication for Western audiences taking a very different look at spiritual questions and issues, and oftentimes doing it with, in direct response to what they saw as the Judeo-Christian tradition out of which people came. And I remember one time coming upon an advertisement in this journal that had, you know, the international symbol for something being outlawed, you know, the circle with the slash sign. And it was a circle, and in it, it had written sin with a slash across it, which I think is probably pretty much the position most of my Sunday school teachers would have taken. No, no, no. But what it said underneath was, this is the greatest calumny against humankind. You know, this is slanderous to speak of humankind in these terms. And I was, you know, now, shortly after I had seen that, I spoke at a large congregation in the Twin Cities area, very active lay people, and I was stunned at the enthusiasm, I mean, and downright, I mean, sort of rebellious streak about the work of Matthew Fox, of whom we've not heard so much recently. But I'm sure some of you yourselves remember when his work was being read. Great deal, his argument is that the Christian tradition took a bad turn in what he calls sort of the Augustinian stream with its negativity around original sin. And he counterpoised to that what he called original blessing, an understanding of how we are created, the goodness that is in us that we could draw on. And this was immensely, I think, I mean, it still is, but it was when Matthew Fox spoke, people flocked to hear him. And Matthew Fox himself was a Roman Catholic, a priest, also a member of the Dominican order, although, as you may know, he has been disciplined because of taking positions that are certainly not representative of what his community of origin sees its teaching to be. But I was earlier in my career, and I was really struck by the response of these people. And then I found it mirrored in other congregations where I had occasion to speak or work. And it wasn't just the young South Minneapolis crowd who did yoga with me, you know. I mean, these were people like my parents, right, who clearly were coming at this issue with a different amount of life experience and having some serious questions about the way the doctrine of sin had been presented to them. I spoke one time at a conference in Atlanta, Georgia. And I remember we talked about the issue of sin there, and what was one of the most moving things, I had a woman come up to me afterwards who said, "I've been a Lutheran all my life, and I've never heard sin spoken of in a way that didn't cut me off at the knees." And I remember thinking, then we have failed. That's simply it's a horrible image. I mean, it's a horrible image. Of saying if what you're telling people is that they already come into a condition that is crippling or disabling for them in some way, and then the way you go about it actually compounds the situation. I remember it really, she was sobbing, and I remember thinking, my heavens, she's the age, she's my mother's age. You know, can this be redeemed? A lifetime of that, can this be redeemed? So now I've moved out to California, where people are always joking to me that the only thing the school systems really care about is self-esteem, and we have the most egotistical morons in the country. And I, you know, I sort of back away from that a little bit. I mean, I think that we're all faced with this, though, about, and as a teacher, I come up against this a lot. About what do you, I mean, how are you critical of people? How do you call people to account when you are preparing them for a public ministry? And at the same time are not demeaning of who they are, or pretend somehow or other we're glad to have you and we'll overlook all the things that are wrong with you, instead of being able to recognize that oftentimes it's through just these fractures that the grace of God just pours forth. And that they are not left in a sort of a posture of really despising themselves, or in a way, what I have found with many people who've become estranged from the church, as I've talked to them, what I realized is it's a kind of fight for survival. It reminds me a little bit of knights of old, you know. I have cast down my gauntlet, and if I am to defend my own sense of self-worth, I have to throw this off because it has been so harmful to me. And if you have, some of you have probably done some therapeutic work, and in the course of my seminary teaching, I've had contact with many people who are in the therapeutic field, who do psychiatric counseling or spiritual counseling or whatever. And I remember one time having one say, was doing some theological work, and I said, "Well, what drew you to this thinking? Oh, this is great." He said, "Well," he said, "I tend the people you lacerate, and I figured I needed to know what was going on." Which to me was, I mean, sort of horrifying. Now, what I want to make clear is, I don't think that, I mean, that's a sign that something has gone wrong. Not that the teaching is false, But there's one of the wonderful things about Lutheran teaching, and Randy was saying yesterday, when people are trying to find a core identity, what does it mean to be Lutheran? One of the most helpful things to me, it's an awkward phrase, but in a book on the Lutheran confessional documents that Robert Jensen and Eric Gritsch wrote many, really probably a generation ago now in the 70s, which I still find one of the richest books to consult in their thinking about these confessional documents from the 16th century, how we use them today. And they look at the central article, you may have heard this phrase, the article by which the church stands or falls, is the fourth article of the Augsburg Confession, presented in 1530 by the Lutheran princes to the German Empire. And that article is the one that spells out justification by grace through faith apart from the works of the law. Okay. And that for them, that was the centerpiece. It is the fourth. Now, it's interesting if you look at the way they unpack, right? When they talk about, they'll talk about God and the Son of God, then they talk about this article of justification, and in a way, what you can say is once that one's on the table, everything that follows is, if this is true, how does everything else look? And on that basis, Grich and Jensen argue that it isn't just a matter of getting the content right, but that, here's the clumsy phrase, that it's a metalinguistic instruction. Well, everybody needs one of those, right? Right? But what they mean is, it's not just what you say, it's how you say it. So that if one thinks of a real piece of a Lutheran identity, and this is one of my favorite games. It's a tacky one, but have you tried this? When you're sitting through a sermon where it's sort of making you feel sick, and you think, what is wrong with this sermon? It's fascinating how well we can get the content right and say it in a way that is just crushing. God loves shit. You know, that's sort of it comes out. And the good news, you know, God loves your shit because of sin. And the good news is God loves shit. I mean, that sort of, as one of my colleagues at Luther put it, that's the three-point sermon in a nutshell. In a bad way, right? Or say, now, if you only believe and have faith in the grace of Jesus Christ, you don't have to do anything and you'll be saved. Got it? Right? And there is sometimes this kind of, get this doctrine right, darn it. And then, you know, but there, that still ends up sort of crushing. Their point is that the real mark of our proclamation is one that how we are present to one another, how we do our works of love, how we speak our words of forgiveness. Grace needs to be our adverb. Right? That it happens graciously, that it is done with grace. And in some ways, I tell you, that's the work of discipleship. That's the work of a lifetime. There are no simple recipes. But it is precisely to me what invites us into that realm, in some ways, of creativity. What is going to sound like grace to this person? Here's another nice image for it. I'm not always so great with martial images, but hey, I just had a little set to with my toddler this morning. She likes to pretend she's a ninja turtle. And I'm finding this kind of good. Now, whenever you take a word of grace to somebody, what Grich and Jensen would say is, they're gonna come back at you with a but. All right, yes, that may be true, but. Well, sure, God loves, but. Right? And you have to think of the gospel as this immensely flexible word that can counter every but they throw at you. Right? And that is an art not just of what is said, but how it's said. And very often it comes, I think of people who say, I have this woman whose self-esteem is so pit low. I said, you know, you may never be able to get her to verbalize or to see the splendor with which God sees her. But you'll say it, and you'll be there, and you'll be there throughout her life. And that is a sign to her that she's wrong and God's right. You know, that it may be partial. It may not be all you want. So I offer those as ways to think a little bit about, well, how is this sort of giving us choreography? How are you going to make your moves through life? And in some ways, that what's important about this Lutheran vision is not so much where you stop, but how you move. You keep moving. So I want to kind of pull sin into this framework, because my fear about sin is that it gets to be like a full stop. You know, you get hit with that one, and you don't really know where to go from there. And one of the things that has changed it a lot for me is having a child. What I began to realize is that I think I've learned what I'm supposed to do about sin. And you know how you kind of file it and say, okay, that's right, but you know, it doesn't do a lot of good like to think about that all the time. It's kind of like tax time, you know, when it's due, you do it, and then you get on with life. And suddenly it dawned on me that I've had this adult way of sort of making it bearable. But now I'm starting with somebody who doesn't have any of those coping mechanisms. Now, what am I going to say to her? Like, one of my big jokes to people is, if you make a sampler to put over Lucy's crib, please don't let it be that one that said, "In sin, my mother bore me." Right? That is not sort of the entree biblical verse I want. Although it sort of speaks to origins. I just don't think that's helpful. Right? And I mean, what that did, though, was it sort of stopped me and thought, yeah, so what is it I want to say? And then, how do I want, so we talked yesterday about this ordering, law and gospel. Can you really hear the word of grace if you aren't first brought to a recognition of your need for it? But I also add, I think in this infinite wisdom of God, there is also a way in which, and the confessions see this quite clearly, you cannot love where you are frightened. Now think about this, people from whom you think bear great wrath towards you and who have good grounds to despise you, do you really find yourself drawn to have any kind of intimacy with them? Right? That there is a way in which the hearing of the word of sin has to be in a context of love. It has to already be in that context of grace. And the point is that it is for God. I mean, think of what Paul says about until the gospel came, what was the difference, sort of? That there is this way in which God speaks in righteous anger against what is seen wrong, but that is not absent from God's love. And that however we talk about sin, we have to be sure that people already stand on some ground whereby they can sustain that word. And if what they're left, can you blame them for denying it? For just saying, or the way I put the question, is it helpful, is it true? Well, how many times do you say, you know, I'm not really, who knows what's true, but I need to find out what's helpful to get through the day, to get through this time in my life. I mean, I remember a friend of mine, and we were talking about it, having both gone through marital disillusions. You know, there's the lovely euphemism. You know, it kind of makes it sound more like a surgical procedure. And neat, clean, and it heals. Well, it's not neat, it's not clean, and it doesn't heal. And one of the things, I remember we said to each other, it was so hard, is on the other side of the line, it had been pretty easy to pull out the biblical verses and know what that meant. That God doesn't like this, it's sinful. And she said, now I find people saying that to me, and my only response is to say, you're not telling me something I don't already know, but it's not helpful, because now I have to go on. Right? I have to keep living. I can't stop here. That this defines what my life is. And then I thought, this is the thing about how do we look at these things that we see as sinful, that we are able then to say, but they're part of a bigger picture. They are not where God starts. God starts and ends in love. And it's precisely because of that that God can deal with them. So I think that one of the things we need to look at is, first of all, what our tradition says sin is. And I think this is interesting because, by and large, we move very quickly to a kind of moralism of specific actions or things that happen that are bad. The confessions see the problem with a much deeper origin, and that is in a fractured relationship with God. This is not of any individual's making. I think this is the other piece, is to recognize that sin has these extraordinary communal dimensions. If we're going to talk about community, I think we ought to recognize that one of the things that defines and binds us as a community is our sort of shared chain of sin, that we, by which we form and deform one another. That the confessions say sin is the inability to fear, love, and trust God rightly. And believing that God is the source, then, of all love and faithfulness, this inability at the root of our existence, then throws a monkey wrench into every other relationship we have with every other thing or person we would love, with every time we would seek to trust. Right? It's like an orientation that's unstable. That makes sense. I mean, I think this is part of one of the things that you try to image this. You have God and you have humans and you have this relationship between them. And in many ways, what the confessions are saying is, it's not that something gets fixed in you or that something gets changed in God. Like, first God was angry, and now that God's had this delicious blood sacrifice, God is slaked and now can be free to love. The problem is in the relationship. And because this one throws us off balance in an inability, even our best instincts to love and trust, Calvin has a lovely term for it. He says there's a natural knowledge of God. What it produces is a factory of idols. That even with our best intention, we're always trying to substitute something in there for the one thing in a way we cannot get on our own. So if we are the objects of outrage and anger, I think we also remember we also are greatly to be pitied. Coming into you really are helpless. That's what bondage to sin means. That the root problem of this alienation, of this inability to know and to trust and to love God, is something we can't fix. We're just captive to it. And one of the signs of it is that many people don't even recognize it. They don't even see it. They don't know it. Now, the confessions, Luther in particular, has this lovely description of what the result of it is that the person in sin is curved into him or herself. Curvatus in se is the Latin term he uses. Now think about that. A relationship, if God is here and here, what you need to do is to be able to look out. If you're curved into yourself, That's precisely what you can't do. I'll give you an image that has been a very powerful one for me. My best friend from high school, who lives on the East Coast, ended up adopting a little girl from Latvia who turned out to be born just 7 days before my Lucy. So as my friend Laurie and I said, we were always late bloomers and we kept a common pace even with motherhood. And so we have these little four-year-olds when we're both in our 40s, And when she brought Sarah back, when she went over with her husband to get Sarah in Latvia, the child made, when they went to the orphanage, I got a postcard from her and she said, I'm concerned because we had Sarah all afternoon, but she didn't connect with us at all. But she does have some eye problems. So we're hoping that what it is just the difficulty with her eyes and the fact that she's used to an orphanage regimen where people come at scheduled hours and you don't interact in between. But she didn't know. When they got the little girl back to the United States, it turned out she has strabismus, which is that, very crossed eyes. The doctor said, her eyes are so severely crossed that she really isn't seeing very much. And so when she was 8 months old, they were operated on, and within 6 weeks, she had made this dramatic advance in her developmental. And I got a funny phone call from my friend who said, I worried a lot, but I guess it is pretty hard to interact with the world and your parents if all you can see is the bridge of your nose. And what struck me is that in a way, what is being described as this original sin is the rupture of the relationship that lets us look out, actually throws us back on ourselves. And we are so caught in that it is like we cannot see beyond the bridge of our own spiritual nose. That grace has to intervene in some way to open our eyes, not just to the God who loves us, but to the world that is around us. And I saw Laurie and Sarah a few weeks ago, and Laurie explained to me that one of the attendant difficulties with having strabismus is that it can produce lazy eye. and so that they have to check Sarah all the time, because if you begin to favor one eye, which is exactly what happened to my friend, this is the wonder that she would end up with an adopted child like this. If you don't intervene early, even though the eye, the lazy eye, is physically sound, the brain never learns to use it. The neurotransmitters are formed from monocular vision, so that my friend has two sound eyes but sees out of one, basically. And so that's when you see people, when they patch the eye, so that the lazy one will have to start working so that the brain will learn to use it. So I'd offer that as sort of an extended image when we talk about, as the Lutherans do, about being simul justus et peccator, simultaneously saint and sinner. That the fact that you have, that grace can lift one, turn one out of oneself to the world, at the same time, this impaired condition in some sense persists. It's pretty easy suddenly to wind up back like that, or blind in one eye to what the world has to offer and what the world calls you to do. And in some sense, I think we can look at this community of grace in which we belong, the sacraments themselves and the way we call one another to account, saying, you need a patch right now. But that, and so this has always been sort of a challenge in the Western tradition about, with the Roman Catholic Church at Luther's time, their argument was they were not comfortable with this phrasing of being that you're simultaneously saint and sinner. You're either in a state of grace or you're out of one. And when you're out of one, you get back into one. Right? But I think we need still to hold to this language in some ways of kind of cure. We are never made more lovable in the eyes of God because we get better. But we don't want to pretend somehow or other that, you know, that found in sin and forgiven is about as good as it'll get on earth. That there really are possibilities for growth and for change in which God delights. But they are the very result of God's loving us. That was sort of the crux of what they fought about at the time of the Reformation. That this justifying grace that forgives sin and changes this relationship between God and the human beings comes before the human beings are able to do anything, rather than results from the human being's contribution to the process. Right, that was sort of the big. And I think I spend a lot of time making sure students have this straight. And then I will be honest with you, when all is said and done, I have many friends from traditions who think the other way, and I think, you know, empirically, it's sort of hard for either one of us to prove it, right? I mean, when we're on the road to discipleship, sometimes I don't worry too much about fighting about how we got there, just that we need to do what we can to keep each other there. But these have been significant differences, and one of the places where you could see the weight of it would be, this is, remember, for Luther, if anything is put on me to make this work between me and God, and what I know is the power of sin to pull me back, I am not secure. Right? But if I can rest my trust in a God who will intervene with grace to forgive and grace to transform, then I can go forward in hope. And that if the fracture at the beginning of sin is the inability to believe that God would do that, right, then you can see how the whole thing goes off. And that is that's a very different problem from just saying, well, he's lazy, he's gluttonous, and he's adulterous. You know, I mean, all of those things may be true, but they have a deeper root. They have a deeper root. Luther himself, in a most revealing moment, said that as he struggled to find some certainty of God's goodness, he said, I came to hate this God. Okay? And he knew that really was the weight of the brokenness. of not being able to find a clear, and you either come to reject God in anger or to flee God in despair. So I want to say one more thing about what I look at as the communal nature of sin, and then have some time for you folks to respond and ask questions. I think too often one of the problems as we look at the Reformation is that you get a very individual sense of what's wrong, so that if I get my faith right and I clean up my act, things are fine. And we all know that one of the dangers, of course, in the communities in which we live, we try to form a lifestyle that we think manifests our commitment to Jesus. But the truth is, we can come to very different conclusions about what needs to be done. The sign of God's forgiving, gracious presence to us, frankly, will never be vested in our sort of platforms for proper behavior. That's why what our confessions always say is the true marks of the church are the gospel truly proclaimed and the sacraments rightly administered, not the disciplines of the community. Right? They don't say those are unimportant, but they do not have the same certainty of God's gracious presence in the word and in the bread and wine and the water. So, for example, to pick a very contested one, the issue of homosexuality. That some communities would argue that that absolutely cannot be accepted by any person who claims to be true to the Christ who's proclaimed in Scripture. I mean, that's what the Southern Baptists pretty much voted when they decided that they were going to boycott Disney. And I don't want to make it, because that to them is, all right. But there are other communities where we would, even if we disagree with their conclusions about this, we would have to recognize their faithfulness, who would reach a very different conclusion about what manifested graciousness. And I think one of the dangers often is these sort of restricted lists of do's and don'ts that somehow or other separate the sinners from the saved. When I was a parish pastor, now I'm a German Lutheran. German Lutherans, like Martin Luther himself, drank beer. When I got to the Midwest, it was very clear that many Norwegian Lutherans did not. But when I was in Connecticut, when I was a parish pastor, I had a neighbor who belonged to the Nazarene Church. And she had a cat from the same litter that I had a cat. I had to go to a continuing education event at the seminary and leave my cat. So I asked her if she would feed him while I was gone. Now, this was right after my installation, and I had a number of friends come, and we had gotten some beer. And the only thing that was in the refrigerator was beer and cat food. And I thought this required some explanation. And I remember her looking at me and saying, "Oh, but you're a pastor. I didn't think pastors did that." Now, I, of course, wanted to say, "Well, I don't eat cat food regularly." But I knew that this was probably not the moment for a smart because I did need her to feed my kitty. But I remember thinking, in a way, here really was a terrible crisis of confidence in me for this, because she liked me. And we had done things together and prayed together, and now we, you know, and we had half kitties that were, you know, and now here was this. And that's where I'm just saying, we can't, I don't mean to make fun, but to recognize that communities shape these things differently. What become meaningful practices for their discipleship. And the other piece that I think is very important is that, remember, none of us comes into this world sort of untouched. It's not much time at all before the limitations of the place where we are born, the conditions under which we are born, begin to take effect. And I would offer here this example again of the eye. You can grow up in families, for example, think of people we know who have grown up in alcoholic or abusive families and the way the patterns repeat. even if on some level they know better or learn better later, how very difficult it is. Because the whole person is formed. I mean, think of that. Twisted by it. I think another, when I moved, I consider myself sort of liberal. You know, I grew up in Maryland and the schools were integrated when I was in ninth grade and it was pretty difficult and all that. But you know, when I got to California and I moved into the place where I'm living, I came out one morning, my delightful child had had a tantrum. I was standing outside telling me I was a terrible mother and she wasn't going to come inside. And I thought, well, that actually sounds pretty good right now. So I said, well, I'm going to take the groceries in. You let me know when you change your mind. And I went up the stairs and I went in. And suddenly this person came running out because he'd heard this crying child. And he said, is she okay? I just wanted to be sure she was okay. Well, I was like, oh. But more than that, I thought, oh, he's black. My neighbor's black. Well, I never had a black neighbor before. And what I realized was, subliminally, everywhere I'd lived, one of the signs of a neighborhood being the right kind of neighborhood and safe was that they were always white. Now, I wasn't consciously choosing that, but I just knew that. And it was so eye-opening to me about the way a world that I didn't choose shaped me without my even knowing it. We are all part of that. You think of the scene from A Christmas Carol. Remember when Jacob Marley comes in with his chain and says, Ebenezer, yours was this long 7 years ago, and you've been adding to it ever since. Well, that's how we come into this world, with this unbelievable chain. And it's part of what our children inherit. About what we've done to, and let me say, and it's not always deliberate. It's not like we sat around and made malicious choices. We didn't always know what would happen or what the results would be. Think about the one in front of us now about cloning. Does anybody in this room feel really competent to resolve that? Huh? So I'm saying is that these kinds of things, to recognize that we are not sort of individual sinners, that it's sort of a contained personal account. It's not just that, and that the problem is bigger in huge ways in terms of how we stand before God as a people. And that scriptural saying about the sins of the parents will be visited on the children unto the seventh generation in some really eerie way is true. Is quite true. This, it seems to me, is why I worry. We look at our children, we look at the things they shape, and I think, does the time come in our own lives where, like my friend who has an eye that's sound but simply cannot see, that there are some decisions, there are some possibilities that are no longer open to us because things have just been, have died in us. As we or never come to life as we grew. I mean, this, and that to me is the point. And let me say, it was the point, I think, where I finally took sin seriously, where somebody said to me, in a very critical situation in my own life, you need to recognize this is not going to get better. See, he's not going to change. And that, and I remember thinking, oh, now here's works righteousness in a kind of a positive mode. Loving, good-hearted Jane, you'll make everything okay. I'll just make it okay. Well, you know, and Josephine said, you can't. It's not in your hands to make it okay. It's at that point, it seems to me, that people who get tired of being told that they're crummy, but thank goodness God likes crummy things, and just say, I don't need that. That's not helpful, all right. And the place where the power of our message is the evil, the death, the power of death and darkness is so deep. And it is not just about you and you didn't make the right decisions and if you'd only done this and you'd only done that. But where is the hope? in an exam I gave last semester at PLTS, and if you ever get a pastor from the class that graduated last year, you're going to be doing splendidly. I was so impressed with him. I said, you go to a family who's got a newborn daughter they have to baptize, and they can't imagine anything finer than she is. What are you going to tell them about the Lutheran doctrine of original sin so that they, like, have a better reason than just getting the kid done for going through with this? And you'd be surprised. I mean, it is, you know, I mean, people are like, well, I don't think she needs it. I felt that way about my sewing circle in my congregation. These old Finnish women really gave the lie to original sin as far as I could see, but they assured me when I got to know them better, that they too stood under the same condemnation. But I had a student who wrote this wonderful essay in which he said, right now it isn't that way. And of course you will see these wonders and splendors in your daughter, and they will always be there. And you will bring her up and give her possibilities, and then there will come the time in her own life where she's not within the realm of your being able to protect and care for her. And she'll see something that she feels should be done, and she'll find herself unable to carry it through. And she will know the disappointment of not living up to the best of what she had hoped for herself. And she will see it around her. And she will know what it is to be helpless. And what you will have given her in this is a ground for hope. Because you won't be able to argue that away. And I was so impressed, you know, at thinking ahead, because it, when that horrible moment of recognition comes, what is it to say, you know it now, God has always known it and made provision. Right? So that one is able, I think this is, you know, I heard a speech given, and I'm so bad about names. It was at a conference that I attended where I was doing the Bible studies. And this man was talking about parish dynamics. And he talked about, you know, how we have these sort of paradoxes. He said, you know, a good way to look at things like this is that if you took, here's a problem and here's a solution and here's a problem and here's a solution. And if you get too far over on this side and solve too much, you create an imbalance and then you've got the other problem again. Which is, I think, just what we could say about that, you know, whatever happened to sin? Well, William Bennett is bringing it back into popularity, you know, but that there really was a time when we didn't talk about it. Now we're sort of like, well, now, wait a minute, we've gone too far over there. Right? And this man, he said, you know, the way to think about it is, look, if you took those four boxes and you went this way, what you'd have is the sign for infinity. That what we need to think is not how do we resolve the paradox of being saint and sinner, but how do we manage it? Right? That there are times when the word of sin, bizarre as this may sound, is good news. Because it helps us make sense of a world that is crushing. And I found that very helpful. My nephew, when he was, he's 17 now, you know, he is really a wonder of the Western world. But when he was going into adolescence, he was typical. So they always sent him to visit me. And I remember he was at that stage when he was about 12, you know, where he was like, he knew everything. It's kind of like being four, as far as I can tell. And, you know, and he'd just be big. And, you know, you finally get to the point, you know, where you just want to say, will you shut up? You know, and you'd say something that would be kind of really, really a put down, you know, and he'd be in tears. And I thought, this is what God is up against. Right? We are, in one sense, really up against sinners. Right? But we are unbelievably fragile. Right? If this is a word of judgment that is to make space for life, we got to be careful that it isn't a word of judgment that just frankly flattens people. And we're tricky that way. I mean, we're really tricky that way. So I think that this is how, I find the older I get, the less I could ever imagine letting go of the doctrine of sin. But I also know that statements like, you know, total depravity are not really very helpful. They're just not very helpful. It's like one of my friends said, when you read the confessions and they talk about how we remain good creatures of God, but we're shot through with sin. She said, I always have this feeling it's like a piece of Swiss cheese. Move the holes from Swiss cheese and still have it. That what is often the irony of us is that the veins of both what make us splendid and what make us vulnerable to the worst of our falls run together. Are one and the same thing, depending on the situation. And so when Luther rejected in his 95 theses, he said, I don't like the way you guys define penance, you know? You go to church, you say you're sorry, you do a penitential act. I get this line from the new movie Hercules, you kiss, you schmooze, we get on. Sort of, you know, I mean, this is not what it's about. That repentance is sort of just what I'm describing here. It is sort of this constant sort of attention, recognition of this movement, of where it can take us, where its faults can be, and always a willingness to think again, to turn again, to try it another way. That I think Luther was very wise about. But it's not tears and sackcloth and ashes all the time. See, I mean, that grounding in the hope of forgiveness and baptism is to say, these are the points of real joy. And let me say, this is one place I think we can learn a lot from the therapeutic community. My unsupported historical assumption is, frankly, they learned it first from us when the church did its good spiritual guidance, is that those of you who've done any of that kind of work, no, oftentimes you're working at something that's just hurtful and it's bitter, and suddenly it shifts and it's different. And you just want to go out and cheer. You just want to go out and cheer. You want to go up to people and say, gosh, I used to be a pathological liar. I found a different way to deal with it. You know, well, you don't do that. But, you know, but there ought to be, I mean, you know, or these things that, and I think that really is what we're getting at here. But perfection is not possible or what we're after. And I think there was another one of Martin Luther's. He said, he didn't want to be a hero. He said, a forgiven sinner, that's the best I'll ever be. And if it's good enough for God, it's good enough for me. So let me stop there. Questions or comments?
Wow. I know,
yeah.
As a person who's been basically raised in the church, as you're getting older, you think, when am I ever going to get past some, you know, and then you think, okay, I've grown past that stage, and, well, here's something else that I'm going, you know, that is creating a distance between me and God, and, you know. And I one time went to one of the older people in our church, and I said, did you ever get to the point where you just felt like you had arrived? And they said, no, actually, the older I get, the more I see my need, and the more precious my relationship with Christ is. And it's not a, you know, what a rotten life I've had. It's a joyful statement. It's not a, you know, I've been a bad person all my life. It's always been, you know, yes, I have needs, and, you know, the older I am, the more I realize that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think there's another thing when Michael Pelt was talking yesterday about, you know, the self-help books and the steps. I think one of the dangers can be here is that, no, are you a 12-step Christian? You know, or are you arrested somewhere lower on the rung that people can really worry? And this is another piece where I think it's the fluidity. And do you know who I have really found so helpful to read in this? And I, again, in a Protestant training, I didn't do a lot with medieval mysticism. How about you guys? Yeah. I mean, hey, did you get to write a report on them in confirmation class? But when I'm teaching, you kind of have to expand. And I was fascinated by, these are the people you think of as really sort of the Olympian athletes of God, you know? And their description of precisely this kind of fluid, you know, that if you spend your life, you know, I think almost like you work and work and work at it, you know, but at some point, God lifts the mist. And it's like you may be in readiness, but you don't make it happen. And for us, I think the two places we probably get caught, I mean, really around this idea of sanctification. See, I think one of the hardest things for Lutherans is to square, when I talk about the balance of discipleship, I'm going to talk about that tomorrow, but what does it mean? How can you be sanctified and be a sinner? Which actually was one of the problems that the medieval church had with this articulation of doctrine. And I think that there's a way in which when we live a life of faith, we do live a life based on sort of foretastes, moments that give us an indication of what we are called to. And so, for example, how many of you go to communion, right? I mean, I can remember those Sundays where I'd be sitting through my service thinking, God, I wonder if we're going to have time to get over to Target before we have to get home, because training pants are on sale and they go out really fast and I don't want to have to try. You know, I'm just sitting there thinking, ooh, can't gain. You know, now, how many of you have had Sundays like that, though, where you know, you in some sense go through the motions? And then you have one of these moments at a Eucharist where you look around and you think, I know I don't, you know, we've had disagreements about this or that or the other thing, and I know there is no other place on earth where I would want to be than in this moment, where with people with whom I do not all agree, and yet I know the love that binds. I mean, it's this moment when you think, here is the body of Christ. It's sort of like I'm standing at the navel of the world. It's happening. I want to say, I think the same thing I said to students, just as we look at just that kind of gift of grace, it's a gift. I think the same thing happens in sanctification. I think there really come moments. It's a little bit like when you were learning to ride a bike, and all of a sudden you looked around and went, nobody's holding the fender, you know, and you just sort of take it off, that you have a moment where something needs to be done. You know what the neighbor needs. You do it. You don't have a second thought. And suddenly it's over and you think, I really was free of myself in that moment. I was wholly me because I could wholly see them. And it doesn't go on forever, but it's a sense, you know that to which you're called. My friend in seminary commented, my best friend there one time, she said, you know, once you've tasted that, you could spend the rest of your life seeking for it to happen again. And I think that's true. So that even there, it's gift. But once you've had it, even though you don't make it, you know, your world is never the same. It's that bitter, but you can't go back. You can't unknow what you've known. You can't unsee what you've seen. And so even though we've had this argument in many ways with the late medieval tradition that says grace enters into a person and really changes them so they become a person who can do good works, and we say, no, it's the relationship that changes. We stay, well, as I said to somebody, think of what we know now. Those of you who've been at Mark Twain's sessions thinking about relationships. Relationships make us who we are. In the end, if that relationship with God and the world changes, it's as deep an ontological change as I can imagine. You know, not just be transformed in my flesh into a saint, but to be transformed into somebody who sees and loves, because somebody has seen and loved me and demanded the same. I'm different. So I think we want to be careful about underestimating the dramatic change that takes place in us, even though the theological language we use in some ways makes it sound like, as my best friend growing up was Catholic said, I guess God just doesn't get as far with you Lutherans as he does with us. I said, well, perhaps he has not as far to go. That was pre-Vatican II. We straightened. But we would tease each other a lot about that because she laughed, you know, about... but you know what we have to remember is that what we're always arguing here is that it's not that some people are good and cooperative. When God comes to a sinner, what God comes to every one of us is persons who are really hostile and frightened and resistant. So that you have to recognize, you know, that this, that in that sense, it's common ground on which we stand. Right. So I think it can help us understand also the places where people balk. You know, we try to move forward in our Christian life, especially as a congregation. Sometimes that feeling is to recognize. Remember, Scripture tells us perfect love casts out fear. That in many senses, I think you could argue with Luther the opposite, as I will say tomorrow, the opposite is a little pitch of freedom is not bondage. The opposite of freedom is fear. And I kind of like that when they say the inability to fear, love, and trust God rightly. It's the wrong kind of fear at work among us. Other comments, questions? As you can see, I'll fill up the air, but please seize it.
Well, I keep thinking of a story my husband often told. He was in a group of pastors, and they were dealing with unwed mothers. And one of the pastors was asking the leader, said, I have such a terrible time convincing them that they're sinners, and then that they're forgiven.
Yeah, and once again, it is that sort of, see, and if you kind of focus on a specific act like that, in one way, it seems like you'd be minimizing the picture. Yeah, just confess that one, and then you're sort of rehabilitated to decent society. But rather, to be able to, I mean, that's the very thing that, because you want to say, well, now let's sort this out. I mean, she may be an unwed mother, but she had her child. I mean, she's made some commitments and a giving of the self. And so what do you parse out here and say, well, that was good, but that was bad. And this is that, you forgive this part, commend this part. You know, I mean, where it seems to me that's the piece of being able to place it in this broader sort of sense of how one stands before God, that we don't always have to be so quick to identify or isolate. It's like doing a chemical thing, you know, the sin parts in people's lives. One of my colleagues at Luther made a very interesting comment that I thought a lot about when he talked about law and gospel, you know, about this bringing the law to people so they'll really know how much they need grace. And he said, you know, I think that we make a mistake to think that our job actually is a lot of diagnosis. He said, what I find often is people don't need me to tell them where the law is at work in their lives. What they need from me is the name and a category, because they know what's pinching. Mm-hmm. And what you really do is help them give birth to a meaningful story of themselves and being able to say, this does not sit right with me. I am not at peace about this. Mm-hmm. You know, why is that? And I found that very interesting. I mean, a kind of a counsel of restraint. In a way that intrigued me. I mean, and he had many years in the parish, and I thought, well, he's speaking of what he knows. In that way that... Because remember, we may be fragile and we may be hostile, but we're not stupid. I mean, that's that's the other side. What God has created, we are not stupid about these matters.
I'm just curious. One of the things that occurs to me is how quickly our culture has changed around us from just in the years that, since I've been to seminary anyway, I was trained pretty much in what the words are, churched culture, and how we're like that. Do you see this any different in a time where we define the culture around us as being unchurched or post-Christian era or whatever the terms you want to use?
I do. You know, that's an excellent question, because I think one of the things about a church culture, as I look back to myself, is that for people to start talking to me about sin, I didn't question that. In a way, do you know what I mean? I would be pretty, that was part of the vocabulary, and I was pretty receptive. And that's what makes me think a bit in terms of mission. We think, where are we going to start? Now, I want to be careful here, because, you know, I think, once again, like on many issues, we have a very schizophrenic society. Because there's a whole group of people who are sort of into therapeutic self-help languages. I mean, this is a caricature, but I mean, who would take it to the degree of sort of putting the band symbol through an idea like sin. On the other hand, we have quite a large group also who respond very immediately to that sort of labeling and identity. I mean, in fact, I was just seeing they were having a big three-day revival in the town where I live in California, and how, you know, so you think, so here again, it depends on to whom you're speaking, but I think you're quite right that what you can't, we have to approach this, I think, with some more clarity, and because we can't assume certain understandings already there, or an ability, you see, in many ways, I think that many of us, we knew how to get by sin to get to grace. I mean, not that we forgot, but do you know that it didn't always stop us dead in our tracks? And there, and I'd be interested in your thoughts about that. Where's the place to begin? What's the first word you want to say? And how, in some sense, is bringing people to use this set of imagery and understanding about sin, something that actually is a later step rather than a first step, because it can't be done until they have some connection with the life-giving force of Jesus Christ. As Luther says, in a way, you know, we are also sinners by faith, that there's no way that we could know the depth of the problem and survive, so that in some sense, we're taking God's word for it. and that's the piece, because you know what often worries me is that I've had people sidetrack me with an argument about sin. So, well, I'm not a sinner. Well, look at this. Well, look at this. Well, look at this. And the way I thought, maybe that's one of those buts that Gretchen Jensen talked about. Because I want to say, all right, you don't have to convince me whether you are or aren't. All right? I mean, but I'd like to hear you talk about Jesus. Who is Jesus in your life, you know? And that it forces them to, I mean, encounter the Savior. If you encounter the Savior, then you have to encounter yourself anew. And maybe that's the place. Do you know what I mean? It is tricky business.
The dilemma in the Lutheran Church has been that we're speaking a language that we're all familiar with, and that the people who come to be a part of our community are often people who are like us. And it's the ones who are out there who are unfamiliar when we start talking, like we've spoken this morning. We don't know quite how to talk to them, with them, about these things. We have a congregation of a worshiping group of 800 people there. And you go, now I know a good portion of these folks don't have this background at all. And so when I start talking about baptism and grace and that, they're going, that's not a point of reference. But for the other half, you know, they're going, right on, you know. And so it's
yeah, that is very, and I think there, I mean, in one way, that's how they learn. I mean, I don't mean that you want to lose them in the tracks, but I think that when you begin to speak of those things, people become curious. If they're there, one hopes, I mean, and I do think that, my dad was a teacher. He always said to me, you can never be too elemental. And I think there's another way in which I want to say, just teaching students in a seminary, I think sometimes our assumptions about how much people people who were part of the tradition really know and understand this stuff are not warranted by what's really there. But I think that, I mean, remember, I mean, Luther did work in a church culture, but I've often wondered which would be harder, to have to deal with people who use some of the same vocabulary and sort of assumptions you did and try to get them to move to give new content to that because you thought it was wrong, or to start with people who in some ways are a blank slate, which is only to say, I don't want us to think that what we have here is so complicated that they can't get it. But, and in that way, I mean, you might find even just reading some of the kind of preaching that he did, I'm really struck sometimes in a very graphic way he can go at it. But there's that piece about the metalinguistic instruction, as they put it, that I think oftentimes it's how you present things to people that will be as important as, you know, as the content, as, I mean, as getting them to articulate those, because how many of them, justification, grace, faith, works of the law, whoa, what would that mean? But the other thing I found sometimes is what I said about how these words can give names to things people already know. See, this is the problem with the pulpit, is that you have to talk to a whole group of people, but if you're in an adult group or you're visiting, you can let them take the stage in some ways to begin to give you the faith story that you can sort of intersect with. Mm-hmm. You know, but it is hard harder if you're at Roseville Lutheran. I mean, no, because you really would have a tremendous number of people quite sophisticated in the tradition whose expectations and demands would be very different.
Yeah. Yeah.
What would feed them? Yep. No, please.
Yes. The other part of it that I think is that's interesting for me is just when we begin to say, well, then let's offer worship experiences for people from different, in other words, it becomes stylized or marketed. In other words, we have a seeker service, we'll have a traditional worship, we'll have a contemporary, and all those kinds of things. And then we have a larger discussion going here of community. The first reaction of a church who is beginning to do that is that, well, you're breaking up the community.
And not only that, but I think in a creepy way, you're giving gradations. When do you get to graduate from seekers? Do you know what I mean? And you want to be careful of that, because I think here's the other thing that to me, kind of a false assumption there, is that somehow or other those people who come in get from those who are already there. We have to recognize that those who come in some sense, with their questions, their questing, and their different experience, will give and challenge. The last thing you want to do is separate them. Because I remember, for example, when
let's not make a mistake. They don't separate them, the people who do that. They just are specific about the issues and the questions that we'll be addressing primarily. And there are believers there among seekers, so that doesn't happen.
And see, I just think in a church with as large a membership as some of those have, in a way, you have no choice. You can't have everybody there at once.